From the moment we wake up to the moment we go to sleep, many of us use music throughout the day to keep us going and to calm us down. But what if music were able to help in the treatment of pediatric cancer patients, or depression in adults, or lower blood pressure for heart patients, or even help kids concentrate better in school? I'm Steven Steigman, and today on Central Standard, we explore the healing power of music therapy, how music affects our brain, and how music therapists are using their voices and instruments to help rehabilitate a diverse population of Kansas City. That's coming up right after this news. Music affects us like nothing else does. It even affects all parts of the brain, including the emotional and motion centers. Everyone can relate to music, no matter if you're young or old, poor or rich, healthy or sick, educated or not. This is Central Standard. I'm Steven Steigman. Bob Marley once said, "One good thing about music, when it hits you, you feel no pain." But can music be used therapeutically as part of the healing process for psychological as well as physical conditions? Music therapy has been a growing form of therapy for the past 50 years, helping patients with everything from Alzheimer's to depression to developmental disorders in children and even cancer treatment. But how can listening to or playing music contribute to healing and even rehabilitation? Today, we discuss the healing power of music therapy. What is the history of it and how is it being used today? Is it effective? And what research is there to show this? Joining us in studio is Dr. Robert Groney, Associate Professor and Director of the Music Therapy Program at UMKC. Bob Groney, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Melita Belgrave is Assistant Professor at UMKC in the Music Therapy Program as well. Melita, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
And joining us from the studios of Kansas Public Radio in Lawrence is Dr. Dina Register, Associate Professor of Music Education and Music Therapy at KU and a former clinical music therapist. She's on the line with us from Lawrence. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for being with us. Let's start with the very basics. What is music therapy? Melita, do you want to start with that?
Sure. Our basic definition is that it's the use of music to work on non-musical goals. So the same way someone would be in therapy to work on cognitive goals like memory or attention, or if someone has motor goals like physical, fine motor, or gross motor, we would just use music as the tool to assist people on working on those goals.
What kinds of programs are there across the country to become a music therapist? Dr. Groney, let's go with you on that one.
For undergraduate programs, there's about 72 programs, colleges, that teach music therapy. There's about 30 programs that go in the master's level area. And there's about 8 programs that work on the doctoral area. 2 of those are KU and UMKC.
It's nice to have those here in our area. What kind of classes do music therapy students take?
They take classes in music therapy, clinical theory and practical use, classes related to psychology, special education, and of course the musicianship is very important, so we go through classes at the conservatory here like any other beginning student in music.
You mentioned that they have to know psychology. Dr. Register, do music therapists have to know anatomy as well?
They do. They take an anatomy and physiology course. They also take different psychology courses to support their study.
And how important is hands-on training in music therapy, Professor Register?
It's very important. We actually have quite a number of clinical hours that students go through through the progression of a program, and then a full-time 6-month internship that follows their study at the university.
This is a judgmental question. What makes a good music therapist? Why don't we go to you, Dr. Belgrave, on this one?
Well, a lot of things. Musicianship, so they have to be proficient on their main instrument, which may have been anything from flute to voice to violin. Then they go through a series of musicianship courses related to music therapy instruments. And the three we use most as music therapists are guitar, piano, and voice. In addition to that, they need to have a helping personality, mm-hmm. that they're willing to help others. And flexibility is our basic other trait that we look for as music therapists, because in one day of practice, an individual may see children in a school setting to older adults in a hospital to a hospice setting, because the day for a music therapist can be very busy and varied.
So what you're saying is trombonists need not apply.
Oh, no, they still can apply. Every instrument is needed.
If you only knew the trombone jokes, I could tell you. Anyway, are there more men or women interested in music therapy, Bob?
At this point, for undergraduate area, being a helping profession the way it is in society, it's about 90% female.
Wow.
10% male. As you move up into master's level and doctor level of professorships, that's getting more like 50-50, but that's kind of the way it is at this point.
Is that the way it is across the country or here in the Midwest, you think?
It's across the country, yeah.
And are you undertaking any efforts to try to recruit more men to music therapy at the undergraduate level? Or do you need to, I guess?
Yeah, I mean, in some populations, it's nice. For example, if you have a population where there isn't a father in the family home, it's nice sometimes to have a male role model. So we have, a couple of our male students have been working at Operation Breakthrough in Kansas City, and they've really resonated with some of the children who don't have fathers at home.
Mm-hmm.
So, and not a super, other than that, push kind of to get males in, but it has to be kind of a caring profession. But it's a good question of why that continues the way it is.
Let's talk a little bit about the history of music therapy. Professor Register, I'd like to go to you on this one. What's the history of music therapy as an alternative therapy? When did music therapy start?
Well, that's a difficult question because, of course, we've been doing this, musicians have been doing this pretty much since the beginning of time. In this country, I think it's formalized really with roots back to post-World War II and veterans returning and being in hospital. And so musicians coming into different settings that we wouldn't necessarily think of as music-based settings. And then as people were institutionalized for mental health needs or for intellectual disabilities, we saw music therapists start to work in those areas. And now, of course, you know, we're in almost any type of environment or facility you can think of, because really from the mid-80s forward, there's been this huge growth and music therapists actually being really innovative about who they work with, how they work with them, co-treating with other disciplines such mm-hmm. as occupational therapy, speech therapy, physical therapy. So we've seen this really a rather fast progression, I would say, in the last 15 to 20 years, and a broadening of the environments that music therapists work in.
So tell us about where we're going to see music therapy 5 or 10 years from now. What are some of the new and innovative things that are happening in music therapy today?
Sure. I think one of the most innovative things that's happening is music therapists now are becoming part of this preventative care movement.
Hmm.
In the lead into the show, you talked about, you know, using music for stress-related types of things. And I think music therapists really are they're really adept at looking at healthcare trends and where is healthcare going and then matching to that.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the other progressive areas, I would say, are things like the neonatal intensive care unit, so work with premature infants and their families.
Really? Tell me more about that.
Yes. There's quite a bit of research in that, actually. Music is used in a couple of different ways.
I mean, I know about music being used. We try to play music for my, yet-to-be-born children. I don't know if it worked or not. They do love music, but
There's some really fascinating studies where music is used. There's actually a device that was created by a music therapist called the pacifier-activated lullaby. And it is connected to a CD player, and an infant who is born prematurely may not have that sucking reflex fully developed.
Mm-hmm.
So the PAL is used actually to help develop that. So the baby will suck on the pacifier, and it will connect to the CD player, which causes the music to come on.
Wow.
Music for most humans is incredibly reinforcing. And same for infants. And so the baby will hear the music. And when they stop sucking, the pacifier-activated lullaby can be set so that the music turns off in different durations, and that the baby has to suck either harder or less hard to get the music to go. So this cycle happens that they start to figure out if they want the music, they have to suck. That non-nutritive sucking then translates to feeding. So the babies gain weight sooner and they're released from the hospital sooner. So not only is it a great thing for the baby and the family, it's a cost-effective measure in that case.
Let's continue this for a few moments here. Where has this been in practice? All over the country or here in the Midwest? Or tell us about that.
It is all over the country. It's in various hospitals. There was a list released recently of the top 12 hospitals in the country, and I believe 8 of those actually have music therapy programs. And there is some additional training for music therapists who do work in the NICU. So it's not just the Midwest. It's all over.
Great. I want to get back to some of your research a little bit later in the program. First, I want to mention you're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 FM, streaming live at kcur.org. I'm Stephen Steigman. Our guests are Dr. Robert Groney and Dr. Melita Belgrave from the UMKC Conservatory of Music and Dance, a music therapy program, and Dr. Dina Register from KU. We're discussing music therapy today. Kansas City, have you ever used music therapy or know somebody who has? Does it work for you? Join our conversation by calling 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. You can also email us at centralstandard@kcur.org. Let's talk, does music therapy work in cross-cultural environments? Let's go to you, Dr. Belgrave, on this one.
Yes, because music therapists are trained here in the States, but we also have music therapists that are working in different countries. And one of the things that is common to music therapy is the use of individuals' preferred music. So we can work on those same physical goals, same cognitive goals, same academic goals through music of individuals' culture. So you really can see music therapy being used in different cultures and different areas, as well as in the States and different culture areas.
How about music in a bilingual environment? Dr. Groney?
Music therapy can use in a bilingual environment. One of our students is a co-founder of Musica, which is a Latino music-based program in Kansas City. They're using music to help people to do well in school, to do socialization, to concentrate, that kind of thing. And they're using the music of that culture in order to do that.
How about learning languages? Has music therapy helped in that sense?
Yes. We often focus on folks who have speech or language difficulties or problems, because the centers in the brain dealing with language and speech are also close or with the centers of the brain that deal with music. It's a nice, it kind of works well together. And, of course, there's almost a sing-song quality to speech as well as just singing. And so there's even some techniques in one of our specialties called neurologic music therapy. They use a technique called MIT, melodic intonation therapy. Recently seen with Gabby Giffords, who suffered a gunshot. Some nice video on that if you look it up. Trying to sing first what she wanted to say and try to transition that into saying what she wanted to say. Hmm. So from music to help and then fade out the music to get the functional speech and language going.
Well, there are so many diverse types of music and instruments all over the world. How do music therapists incorporate that into their therapy? Professor Register, you want to handle that one?
Sure. We do that here in the U.S., and I'd like to actually extend the definition of culture beyond a person's language or things like that, because there are so many different cultural aspects that we deal with depending on the facilities that we're working with or the types of families and the ages. So there's different, of course, types of music by culture, but sometimes it's dealing with what's acceptable in a patient or a client's family system in the neighborhood that they live in. So we really deal with that across quite a broad range. One of the things that in the last 5 years we've been able to do through the KU program is take students to Thailand, actually, and work in both a hospital and a rehabilitation facility there, as well as an orphanage.
Mm-hmm.
The students, of course, don't speak Thai, so it's really a phenomenal experience for them to watch people who don't have language in common come together around music. So we are able to still see some really interesting outcomes in individuals and in family systems in terms of their socialization, their participation, their motor abilities through music without having that similar language component.
And what kind of music are you using there? Are you using traditional Thai classical music, or are you using Western tunes, or what are you using?
It's quite a broad range. When I started work with Mahidol University in Thailand about 5 years ago, we went in starting with Western music because, of course, that's what I knew and what we had the easiest access to. And so one of the studies that was an initial study in this program is videotaping sessions and looking at client responses to the music. And so we had great on-task responses. So by on-task, I mean participation and not having to coax someone into being part of the therapy session and looking at their affect. So how are they responding in terms of what they were doing? And then we transitioned from American presenters, U.S. presenters and students to Thai students. And with that transition came the infusion of Thai music. Mm. And so we looked across those videos to see, as we made that transition, was there a change in participation? Did we get better participation with the Thai music versus the Western music? And there was no change. So there is this, I think, being drawn to music, especially in those kinds, in rehabilitation settings and hospital settings, that can be incredibly stressful. And the music brings a levity to that environment, regardless of the type of music. I did have a Thai client who, once we made the transition fully to Thai music with the Thai students working with them, pulled me aside after the group and said, "I think it's really lovely that you're being so culturally sensitive. I really need some American rock and roll." So, you know, it's kind of a win-win, I think.
Well, did music therapy start here in the U.S., or is it just more popular here? That going back to the kind of the history questions, Bob Groney?
Well, that's a good question. At least in the U.S., music therapy formally was organized in 1950. So as music therapy grows, I grow. I'm the same age because I was born in 50.
Uh-huh.
But I can't quite know when it started in Europe. Do you know, Dr. Bilgeria?
Not off the top of my head. Dr. Register?
I will say I think it perhaps was a bit later. One of the most recognized programs is the Nordoff Robbins program and approach, which actually was a collaboration between Clive Robbins, who lived in the UK, and Paul Nordoff, who was a professor of music at, I believe it was Columbia University. He was a composer, and he was actually on a sabbatical in the UK doing compositions. And Clive Robbins was a special educator who worked with children who had multiple issues, so multiple disabilities. And they started working together, and Paul Nordoff would be at the piano. Clive Robbins would be working with the client, and they started seeing amazing outcomes from these children who, in the late 60s, of course, you know, at that time, children were institutionalized if they had developmental disabilities and they were also blind, or, you know, they didn't have developed motor skills and those sorts of things. These children were just sort of warehoused, for lack of a better term, and thought to not have a great deal of possibility. And so through the work of those two, they saw some amazing outcomes using music to help them develop skills. And so My guess would be, not having a firm answer for that, would be probably in the mid to late 60s with Nordoff Robbins. Hmm.
So still a relatively, I mean, as far as therapy programs go, still relatively young, but then again, a good history. You're listening to Central Standard on KCUR. We're streaming live at kcur.org. I'm Stephen Steigman. 816-235-2888, 816-235-2888, if you'd like to join our conversation. Let's say hi to Dan in Lansing, Kansas. Dan, welcome to the program.
Yeah, hi. I'm really glad to hear you guys are talking about this subject. In the last few years, I've been seeing various clients in in-home family settings, and currently I'm working in addiction counseling, and I've been using music to help my clients and even myself relate more to what they're going through and give these clients a kind of an outside looking in perspective to the images that, you know, they want to not keep having in their lives, or just helping them really relate. I mean, I've used songs, everything from real gritty gangster rap to country music to whatever is emotive and what they can express.
Well, Dan, let me ask you, are you a music therapist by training, or do you just, you're using music as therapy in your work?
I just love music and I love counseling. And I've even had clients, I ask them to pick a song that represents them, how they feel currently, and to pick a song that they want to have represent them in the future. Go ahead.
I was going to say that's really interesting, and it sounds really effective. I guess it brings up the broader question for our guests here in studio. Does one need to be a music therapist to practice music therapy? Dr. Groening.
Well, we don't own music, and I always say that. Anyone can use music for any purpose. And it sounds like you're doing some nice things with music, sir. But it's our training and documentation, assessment, the standards of clinical practice we follow, and code of ethics, of course. Our training is about 5,000 hours in academic setting and about 1,200 hours in the clinical setting. And so that kind of helps us to get work on getting third-party reimbursement and that kind of thing for music therapy. So, yeah. And music is just a great thing to have, you know, for everyone.
Dan, thank you so much for the call today. I really appreciate it. 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Well, this kind of gets into the science of how does music therapy affect the brain? I mean, what parts of the brain are affected by music? Melita, do you want to tackle? No, you don't want. Okay, well, how about Dr. Register? You want to tackle that one?
Melita,
I know.
Shame on you.
I'm sure she knows the answer. She just would rather give you the mic time.
Yes, that's what it is.
Well, you know, it's really interesting. KU started conferring master's degrees in music therapy in 1946, and so we have been degreeing professionals for a long time. We have, I should mention, the board certification for music therapists manages the board certification test. So following all of the training and the clinical training, students can sit for the board certification exam and receive the MTBC credential. And so we have been looking at why and how does this work. But really, it's only been probably the last 15 years that the technology has made the brain more accessible to us.
Tell us about some of the technology. Are you actually measuring people? Are you putting people through an MRI as you're playing music for them? How does that work?
There are music therapists involved in that type of research. It's really a partnership between neurologists who are very interested in the brain and who look specifically at. There are brain researchers that are looking specifically at music, though they're not music therapists. So this really is a partnership of coupling with people who have such detailed knowledge of the brain and bringing in the music therapist who has such intimate knowledge of the work of a music therapist and looking at the point where these two things coincide.
So in general, what happens to the brain when music is playing? What do we see?
When you look at a brain scan, when music is playing, what you see is that multiple regions of the brain is activated. So you see the light up of an MRI across several regions of the brain, which is unique to music. So it's fascinating to watch how much of the brain is activated just in listening to music. So that's before we ever even get to active music participation, which is something that we really teach a great deal about, the need to use live music versus recorded music. So you'll see lots of studies, for example, by nurses with the use of recorded music with patients. And some of that is quite effective, but it's the ability of a music therapist to have a live music experience with patients or clients that is responsive to their behaviors. So as they're able to discuss, or we are able to view changes in their behavior over the course of a session, we can change the music and respond in kind. The brain is activated in all different regions. I think Dr. Groney mentioned, or maybe it was Dr. Belgrave, talked about a patient's preferred music, probably the most asked question, I would say, to a music therapist.
I was going to ask Dr. Groney, what happens what happens in the brain when we hear music we recognize, especially with Alzheimer's patients?
One of our professors in music therapy has done a biological foundation of music as therapy theory. He says music is therapeutic because it directly influences brain functioning, which in turn modifies the behavior of other systems that make up the human biological system. So it affects cognition, pain, emotion, movements, communication, anxiety, and stress. I did a study with Alzheimer's patients. I actually did the study because I wanted to see if the quality of musicianship affects the quality of client response.
And I mean, you could go so many different directions with that. See, if you don't play better, people will suffer.
Actually, yeah, it was directed as our students were just still learning that little F chord, and it was kind of tough on that. So I did bring my guitar, and I wanted to kind of demo what we did. We worked with 8 Alzheimer's patients in a community nursing home, and we were doing singing with them, kind of a sing-along. And I did 4 conditions. I did the accompanying with guitar, either in live, I was there, or else I taped my accompaniment, and I played the tape for them, we sang. But I also did a simple accompaniment to a song versus a complex accompaniment to a song. And then I looked up behaviors of whether any of those factors affected the amount of singing, more humming, more clapping, applause, more compliments for me, or less or more wandering away from the area for those Alzheimer's folks who wandered. And I'll give you an example of like the simple accompaniment on the song Side by Side, for example. So I'll kind of mimic a beginning guitarist trying to do Side by Side, you know, and mess up the F chord and stuff. Oh, we ain't got a barrel of money. Maybe we're making it. I'm a little out of tune, too. Funny, but we're traveling alone, singing a song side by side. Then I threw all the bells and whistles in to make a complex accompaniment because I'm a guitarist.
Ah.
And see how it sounded then. Listen to?
Obviously, the second version, yes.
Well, even with patients who had Alzheimer's disease, they didn't sing anymore versus either version.
Yeah.
Because if they were going to sing, they were going to sing. But I got significantly more applause, more people complimenting me, less people wandering away who are wanderers from the scene for the complex version. Complex and live was the best. And then Complex and Taped was the second best. Simple and Live was the third best, and Simple and Taped was the worst. And that showed me that the quality musicianship at least leads to the idea that quality musicianship affects the quality of client response. Since I did that study and I'd studied more on neurologic music therapy, I know that what I'm doing is kind of percussive in the complex, and rhythm affects the brain at the brainstem and lower levels. You can have any kind of cognitive kind of ability and almost tap and step with a rhythm, right? So when you hear this kind of clicking stuff in the guitar, that's almost like a drum or a snare drum going on. So that's another factor that helped compared to just kind of a boring kind of a chord thing.
I'm remembering now a video that I'm sure you all have seen, the one, and I can't remember what program it was on, where it shows this man who has been essentially catatonic for a long time, and they stick headphones on his head and play him they play him Motown music, and he comes alive. What happened there? You can probably do a much better job explaining that and what happened there. Bob?
I'm wondering, I can't remember his age. It might have been long-term memory kicking in. He might have been in a facility where there wasn't a music therapist, and so a music therapist's job is trying to try all kinds of different kind of music and see what the response was. And they may have hit on Motown, and once they hit on Motown, or someone else just not a music therapist playing different things through a laptop or an iPad or whatever for him. And I think that's probably what did it. We see that with Alzheimer's folks. As soon as the music goes, I mean, they start singing.
Dr. Belgrave?
Well, I'd like to follow up with that and just kind of the idea of what happens when someone just stumbles onto the music, like Dr. Groney mentioned, versus if a music therapist is in that environment. When I worked in hospice, I did a lot of work with late-stage dementia clients. And for those individuals, as you're declining into the later stages of Alzheimer's, we see loss of a lot of speech. We see loss of mobility. Towards the later days, the person may not even be sitting up in a wheelchair. They may find themselves bedbound. Mm-hmm. So you can imagine for that person, even though there is someone still inside of there, their quality of life, their activities during the day, it's pretty limited, especially if they're in a nursing home or some other type of long-term care facility. They're not getting out of their room. The activity director's not including them in things. So I got to do a study where I went in and I saw each client individually, and I looked at the use of a cappella singing with different types of touch to engage the person. Mm-hmm. Touch using instrument play, touch using just a touch to the hand, and using their preferred music. And the exciting part for all of those participants is that at some point in time, there was some sort of engagement. So looking at their alert states, and a music therapist would be trained to know, okay, I'm looking for these different mm-hmm. behaviors. I know that it's going to take me a long time for the person to notice that I'm in that environment. So just some of the things that we're able to do as music therapy and pulling that person out.
We'll talk a little bit more about that when we come back. We're going to take a short break, but when we return, we'll talk about research and results in music therapy. We'll also talk with our guests here about their specific areas of research, Alzheimer's, early childhood development, women, and working with the elderly. I'm Steven Steigman. Central Standard returns in just a moment. Welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Steven Steigman. We're talking today about music therapy. Our guests are Dr. Robert Groney and Dr. Melita Belgrave from UMKC and Dr. Dina Register from KU. All three of them are music therapists. We're talking about music therapy and how it can be used in a variety of different ways to treat and help individuals with a variety of conditions. Kansas City, have you ever participated in music therapy? What did you do and did it help? Tell us your thoughts by calling us 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. You can also tweet us at KCURCST. Let's talk a little bit about research and results in music therapy. How much of music therapy is supported by scientific double-blind studies? Let's go to you, Dr. Register, for that one.
That's a really difficult thing to do, I think, in what we do. And there's some ethical questions about that, too, because the anecdotal evidence is that we see how beneficial it is for clients. And so there's always this ethical question of, do we withhold from different client groups when we know that, that we can see results. So you'll see a lot of mixed methods research, I think, in music therapy research. And that, of course, is growing as the profession is growing. We're about 6,000 strong in terms of board-certified music therapists. So,
how do we know that the health benefits of music therapy aren't just from the happiness that music brings rather than the music itself? I mean, in other words, if I were to get happiness from some other activity, maybe that could be just as effective as music therapy, or has music been shown to heal us in a way that no other activity or medium can?
I think it's important to note that we don't try and replace anything. So when we talk about music therapy as a way to manage or decrease the perception of pain, we don't talk about that as a replacement for pharmacological measures, for example. We talk about it as an augmentative sort of thing, in a way to maybe decrease the amount of medication that's needed, or to help patients manage that. So you will find in the music therapy literature that, depending on the factor that you're looking at, pain, I'll go with pain since I sort of started with that example, you will find music therapists that are looking at things like cortisol levels as a way to point to physiological and biological changes that are happening in the body as a result of participating in a live music event. So
music therapy actually has an effect on some physical conditions.
Yes.
Wow.
Yes.
I mean, that's just it doesn't surprise. It's shocking, I guess. Who are the most common patients who use music therapy? Dr. Belgrave, let's go to you for that one.
You know, everything under the sun, basically, and everyone under the sun, because as music therapists, as a profession and as a field and as a people, we're very innovative. And I know for me, when I was studying in undergrad, the trend of practice was music therapists working in special education, music therapists with Alzheimer's disease, maybe a little bit of music therapist wellness, just starting music therapy hospice. And now, you know, 14 years later, as a professor, there's music therapy in intergenerational settings. There's music therapy in hospice is thriving. Music therapy in wellness is thriving. So the skies are the limits when we talk about who we see as patients.
Well, let me ask you this. Was there a time when music therapy was not as well received as it is now? Was there some resistance to music therapy at a point, much like there was resistance to osteopathic medicine, you know, 40 years ago, or chiropractic care? Were some people calling music therapists quacks?
In the early history of music therapy, in the very early history of music therapy, some of our precursors to true music therapy were doctors who were promoting music therapy and using music. There's a picture of a doctor in the Victorian times using it, and later using like a Victrola with headphones on a patient. I think in our early times, historically, music therapy thought we could do everything, and we kind of started claiming all of these things, and then we had to start pulling back when we actually saw evidence and started using evidence-based research and looked at us more as a support, but also that we really had to back up what we were talking about. And we're on that right track right now. We're on that track with some of the subpopulations like autism and Parkinson's and Alzheimer's as well.
We've talked about who can benefit from music therapy. Who cannot benefit from music therapy?
There are some people who music is actually hurts them or is offensive to them, or they have some problems in the brain where music is not effective. Dr. Oliver Sacks, as a center supporter of music therapy, wrote a book called Musicophilia, where he has case studies. He's a neurologist. Case studies of folks where music was actually didn't do well with some of the folks. So we have to check that out. When we use music and some of our techniques, like certain styles of music, I mean, some styles of music, because of associative properties of music, may have some people actually be afraid or hurt. So we really have to decide, because you could have the same piece of music playing, but if you think about what was happening in your past when that sure. music was playing. It could be a big, good experience, a very bad experience.
I'm thinking about PTSD and soldiers returning from combat. Certain songs they heard while they were over in Iraq or Afghanistan, hearing them again, reminding them of situations, or maybe not.
Mm-hmm. Exactly right, yeah.
Well, Dr. Dina Register from KU, sounds like a silly question, but can the deaf benefit from music therapy?
Yes, absolutely. There was actually quite a thriving music therapy program at the Kansas School for the Deaf. And there are researchers in our field, Dr. Alessandro, who's at Florida State University, Dr. Kate Gefeller, who's at University of Iowa, who both work with those populations. And Dr. Kate Gefeller actually does a lot of work with music therapy and cochlear implant patients.
Interesting.
Which is fascinating work, yes.
816-235-2888, 816-235-2888. Let's take a call right now from Karen in Lee's Summit. Karen, welcome to Central Standard.
Hi, I want to thank you very much for this show. I'm glad I caught it today because it's helping me understand a lot about my stepdaughter. I have a 14-year-old who she can't speak and she has many physiological and developmental challenges. And when she was very sick a couple of years ago and hospitalized at great length down at Children's Mercy, the music therapist would come in, but I didn't respect what she was doing the way I respect it now. And I didn't see as much of a response as I do now when we give music to my daughter. Now, of course, my daughter was very sick then and very weak, whereas now she's doing great. But earlier in the year, we gave her an iPod Shuffle, and we put a variety of music on it, and we change it about every 2 weeks, and we use it to either stimulate her or reward her. And I have a whole different respect now for the fact that she responds to the rock drummer music, when you can hear the drums quite a bit, and she loves the jazz saxophone music. Those are the two genres that she really perks up and gets much happier, and she actually pretends to play the drums or pretends to play the saxophone. And it's a whole new world for me now. I'm going to give her that much more music and encourage that much more of that positive attitude that we give, that we get from her when we give her that in the morning and in the evening, which are the two times she's the grumpiest. So I thank you so much. You've opened a whole new window for me.
Karen, thanks so much.
And for our daughter.
Thank you so much for the call. That's a great story. Well, Dr. Register, let me ask you this question. Can music therapy help with developmental problems? How about learning disabilities?
Absolutely. My primary area of research actually is in early childhood and early intervention. So looking at children either who already have an identified developmental need or children that we consider at risk, and that's usually due to environmental factors. You know, tying this back to the question you asked about what do we know about what music does for the brain, there's a really interesting program you can access on the internet. It was an episode of NOVA. And Oliver Sacks, who I think Dr. Groney referred to, they had him listen to his preferred music, which is Bach, and then they compared it to Beethoven, and they looked at the two brain scans. And the interesting thing about this is that the music had very similar properties. So the characteristics of the music were similar in terms of melodically and rhythmically. But his brain actually lit up more for his preferred music, for Bach, than it did for Beethoven. They then selected two pieces of music that were Bach and Beethoven, but they were so similar he didn't know which was which. So he couldn't identify which was which, but his brain could identify his preferred music. So the brain identified, oh, that's the Bach, which would lead us maybe to think that if we get to children when they're very young and we have them engaging in musical experiences, first of all, that is kind of a terrible fallback, but it's fun.
Yeah,
so,
sure.
You know, one of the things that we see with patients in hospital or in rehabilitation settings is it takes some of the work out of those environments. And so if we create that environment for children where they're practicing necessary developmental skills, so speech issues and working on speaking or working on naming objects or working on movement, whatever it is that their developmental need is, doing that in music, we know that music grows the brain differently. So I think that's a really important thing about especially getting to our younger patients under the age of 7 and utilizing music to help them ameliorate some of these problems before they really get to a more severe level, if that makes sense.
Really interesting. Well, this may be opening up a whole different can of worms, but many schools are cutting their music education programs. What kind of developmental effect could this have on kids? I know,
well,
can of worms.
That is a huge can of worms.
I've just opened it up. in 20 words or less.
Right.
I mean, seriously, is there if we have less music in schools at a young age, right. Do you see this causing problems is it just people just want to have as rich lives?
It's not just about having an enriched life. I do think that we underplay the importance of quality of life, but it's not just about that. I think it. For some children, one of the sort of the inside jokes of being a music therapist is that a number of the referrals that we get in any different setting is the patient or the client where the rest of the team looks at one another and says, I don't know, we've tried everything we have. Somebody call the music therapist, see if they can do anything. So we sort of get the last resort clients a great deal of the time just because everyone else is a little frustrated with more traditional methods or approaches.
Does that frustrate music therapists? I mean, if you were called in a little bit earlier, would it make a difference?
It is my favorite client to get because I can't tell you the number of settings I've been in where somebody has said, how did you get them to do that? How did you get that response?
Dr. Groening?
So,
also, I was a double major in music education and therapy. And basically, the history of music education, they don't always tell you in the books, is there's music educators because people in physical education needed a break, and so they sent them to the music education room. So we kind of appreciate when people give us the clients that nobody feels they can do anything about because it's almost like miracles occur sometimes. Our profession talks about how music therapy makes a difference in young children. I'm just reading it from a fact sheet because it's not my area, but music stimulates all the senses and involves the child at many levels, facilitates many developmental skills, as Dr. Register said. She also mentioned the joy of play, but also music is highly motivating, yet it can have a calming and relaxing effect and success-oriented, and there's several other areas.
Dr. Belgrave, I want to get to some of your work with the elderly. You created a choir for the elderly called Forever Young. Tell us about this choir.
Yes. Well, it is modeled after the movie Young at Heart, which is a documentary.
That's
about...
a great documentary if you haven't seen it.
I suggest seeing it. It'll warm your heart. It's about older adults learning rock music. And the Landon Center on Aging over on the KU Med campus, some people there saw the movie. And actually, Nancy Landon Kassebaum Baker is our donor for the choir. She saw the movie and said she wants that at the Landon Center. And so by a very interesting chain of events, they found me to help start and direct that. And we've been going since February of 2010. And I know throughout this hour, I've been talking about preferred music. Well, in this choir, we actually do not do their preferred music because it's a lifelong learning program and we want to enhance their cognitive skills. And the brain loves new and novel. So if I could bring in new songs like Mumford and Sons, and we're singing something by Katy Perry this semester, then the actual ability to retrieve from their long-term memory all of that new information related to lyrics and text, related to pitches, related to harmony, their brain is going wild and very excited through that. So we have cognitive benefits, we have physical benefits, we do a lot of seated and standing movements, and just the social interaction that happens out of the group, because we do performances with the ensemble at the end of every semester, and so that working together towards something new, it also has them the older adults who were involved in the choir an ability to interact with their family members in a different way. So their adult children, that's the music that they're listening to or that they grew up listening to. And so the fact that they're able to communicate through that music now is great. And then I continue to push them, and we actually listen to our music through MP3 players. And I had everything from an older adult who already had an iPad to someone who would say, what's an MP what now?
What's an MP what now?
And now they love it. I've had people ask on where they could buy MP3 players, and we listen to rehearsal tracks and everything.
Well, let's listen to a sample from your choir,
yes.
Forever Young. This is These Boots Are Made for Walking. That is awesome.
And I just want to add that during that...
I am gaining great experience just by listening to... Music therapy works.
And I just want to add two things. One, that they were actually dancing during that,
wow.
And wearing fun boots. But as this program has continued to grow over the past years, it has served as a clinical placement for our music therapy students. So those instruments that you're hearing in the background are actually our music therapy students on their secondary instruments. So those trombone and bassoonists are playing guitar and drums.
How does one join the group?
They can contact the Landon Center, and they're looking for Myra Hyatt. Her phone number is 913-588-2365, or she can be reached via email at mhyatt, mm-hmm. at kumc.edu.
Okay. We'll try to get that up on our website as well. And kind of a final question here, maybe not a final question, but is music therapy covered by insurance?
Music therapy has, since 94, has been a related service in Medicare, Medicaid, and private insurance like Blue Cross in selected areas has covered. We are not across the board. We're working, and in fact, Dr. Register is integral in working on aspects to get licensure in different states so we can have a little more music therapy reimbursement. Dr. Register, maybe you want to speak to that.
Sure.
Go ahead, please.
We have a state recognition operational plan, so we have 43 different states in the U.S. that have task forces in their state that are made up of clinical music therapists, looking at the different structures within the state to figure out how should we be licensed, what's the best fit for that state. We do currently require a license for practice in the state of Nevada, North Dakota, and also Georgia. The state of Wisconsin has a registry for music therapists, so that helps consumers access quality services.
I'm going to have to cut it off there. That's Dr. Dina Register. She's Associate Professor of Music Education and Music Therapy at KU. Dr. Robert Groney is an Associate Professor and Director of Music Therapy at UMKC, and Dr. Melita Belgrave is an Assistant Professor at UMKC in the Music Therapy Program. Bob, Melita, Dina, thank you all so much for being with us today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You can subscribe to our podcast, hear this conversation again, or access any of our previous shows from the Central Standard page of kcur.org. Tune in tomorrow as we explore the developing West Bottoms neighborhood. Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton with help from Ross Steinmetz and Sydney Llewellyn. I'm Stephen Steigman, and this is KCUR.